From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and we are all still digesting the grim predictions from the White House task force about what is to come as the new coronavirus spreads. The task force expects 100 to 240,000 people in this country will die even if every state enacts strict social distancing guidelines. And they're basing their guidelines in part on modeling from researchers, including Dr. Ali Mukdad, a professor at the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation at the University of Washington in Seattle, who joins us on Skype. Dr. Mukdad, these grim numbers are if every state enacts strict restrictions through the summer, way beyond the end of April.
Yes, that's what we're assuming. And states who have not instituted these measures, they will institute them within 1 week from now.
That's your prediction or that's your recommendation?
That's our hope and recommendation, of course.
Now, that is not what's happening so far. Georgia, for instance, which does have a lot of cases, has not issued a statewide order, nor has Florida. Do you think that those states ought to do that right away?
Definitely. What we have seen so far, that these measures do help, and they will reduce mortality and they will reduce demand on our health facilities. And I understand some of these states, there are orders for certain counties or parts of the state. But it's very important to remember that, people in a state, when they see the whole state is totally different when your neighboring county is doing something different than what you are doing. It sends the wrong message for all of us first. And the second one, which is very important, even for some of these rural communities and counties where some of these orders have not been issued, there is no guarantee that the virus is not already circulating there. And then we should be careful and we should be ahead of it and prevent its spread in these communities.
So should there be a national lockdown?
There should be a national request for all of us to stay at home for at least 2 weeks, yes.
How long do you think the social distancing should continue based on the models that you're looking at this point?
We're looking at sometimes in mid-June that we will see the death goes down below 10 per day, which then we feel comfortable that these measures should be lifted. But our recommendation will be they shouldn't be lifted immediately all at once, that we should slowly in case and look and let the data decide in case there is circulation of the virus again, stop it and go back. I know all of us want to get out. I mean, I personally am staying at home. I've been staying at home for a long time. We want to see our loved ones. We want to see our family and friends. But we all have to do our part. And we have to act as we are all infected and practice proper social distancing in order to prevent the spread of this virus.
Your data predicts a peak strain on hospitals on April the 15th. How confident are you of that? And does that mean that that includes people who are getting the virus right now on April 1st?
Yeah, that includes, the incubation period for this virus is 14 days. So we have from the first contact, it could be until 14 days for somebody to come to a medical services or see the virus, be diagnosed with the virus. And now today we're realizing that, this is a new virus. We're learning as we go. We're learning that even some of the patient, people who are infected with this virus, don't have any symptoms. So they could go without symptoms and then they could be spreading the virus. So that's why it's more important right now for all of us to stay at home. Yes, we're estimating the peak to be April 16 at the national level. Some state will see a peak a little bit later, and that's because of some state the virus started circulating a little bit later. Remember, we started in Seattle the first, New York was the second. And that way, some of the peak will be a little bit delayed 1 week or 2 weeks later. But as a nation, it's April 16 where we'll see the peak demand on our resources in the United States.
You were a top official at the CDC. Do you think that everyone should be asked to wear a mask in public? That's, of course, assuming people could actually get masks, which is rather difficult right now. But do you think in an ideal world, everyone would wear a mask right now in public?
No, I don't. I actually, for a simple reason, we don't have enough masks right now. We have many people who like salons who do nails, for example, who have masks. They're donating them to hospitals. Let's make sure that the masks are where they belong right now and with the people that need them the most. I'm not going outside, but if I have to go outside, I'm okay with wearing a scarf or anything else to cover my mouth. And we should do that. But please, please keep the mask for those people who need them.
That is Dr. Ali Mukhtad, who is a professor at the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation at the University of Washington, putting together modeling that the White House is using as it looks forward to see what might be coming with the coronavirus. Dr. Mukhtad, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, now to Wisconsin, where Governor Tony Evers is asking the federal government to issue an emergency declaration for his state to free up federal dollars and FEMA equipment. Last week, like other governors, he ordered non-essential businesses to close. But the state is also seeing a spike in coronavirus cases and deaths in African-American communities, particularly in Milwaukee. And researchers at the University of Wisconsin-Madison say the government can do more to help low-income workers who can't afford to stay home from work. Governor Evers, you've acknowledged this. You've called this a crisis within a crisis. Do you think the government should be paying more people to stay at home?
Well, essentially, we are in some cases, if you look at unemployment insurance, that is essentially paying people that are working non-essential businesses. And we are making sure that they get as much in the way of resources as possible. But yes, it is a crisis. Unfortunately, people that have disproportionately poor health outcomes outside of the virus have it with the virus. And so it's a long-term solution. We have to connect the dots here. We have to have good housing. We have to have good education. So inequality and equity in this state and this nation is not going to be solved by this during this crisis.
Yeah, there's inequity across the country. But yeah, just to keep with the paid aspect of this, you know, 27% of those whose wages fall in the bottom 10% in this country, only 20% of the poorest of the poor working have access to sick leave. Is there a way to, I suppose, you know, maybe not immediately, but, you know, try to get the federal government to include that in bills that we know are still coming, relief bills that are still coming, more sick paid leave?
Yeah, and actually, we're looking at some packages for legislation at the state level that, for some people, we will be able to, you know, if we get agreement, we'll be able to help around the issue of sick leave and making sure that people aren't dealt a financial blow along with the virus.
What about, though, your elections? Your state is going forward with the presidential primary and local elections next week. You know, many other states postponed their elections. And this is, as the Washington Post reports, more than 100 of Wisconsin's municipalities don't have enough poll workers. Tens of thousands of your voters who've flooded offices with mail ballot requests probably won't get them on time. And there are people who are self-isolating who are just finding out that your state law requires a witness to sign a ballot envelope. And some people are alone, don't have a witness.
Well, let's put it in perspective. The requirement for this election is in state law. Mm. It's unlikely to change. It may change by fiat from a court. But I have spent literally days encouraging people to vote absentee, and we have had significant success. This is the largest absentee ballot we've had for a primary that in the history of Wisconsin. So we believe that those will be counted. We are working hard to find those small number of people that need a witness. We'll get a neighbor to come over and make that happen. But at the end of the day, if that doesn't change, and my belief is it will not, this is not just about a presidential primary. We have thousands of elected officials whose positions will be going vacant, and we need them to help us in this virus, solving this virus issue.
Yeah. Well, these difficult decisions, you can't have those offices empty. And we should say that you did ask for mail ballots for every registered voter and also asked to extend in-person early voting, but Republican lawmakers in your state did not back that. You know, just a brief question.
Sure.
Partisan politics would seem secondary, except if they're having an impact on policy. And just want to ask you, there was a story yesterday in the Washington Post as well that Florida had all of its requests met for equipment, this from the federal government. And we know the governor in Florida, the Republican Ron DeSantis, is very close with President Trump. And we're seeing things like at the task force meeting yesterday, the doctors there praising Washington State for its work under the leadership of Governor Jay Inslee in slowing down the outbreak there. And President Trump immediately began walking that back, saying, well, they really only had one outbreak in a nursing home, which isn't true. There were other outbreaks across Washington state. They've done a great job there. Do you worry that partisan politics are playing a role as you're trying to get help from the federal government?
Well, following the stories, the answer is yes. But my focus is on Wisconsin and making sure that we get the equipment that we need to make sure that we're blunting this virus. So it's time for us to come together. If there is a chance to bridge the political divide in this country and this state, the time is now, and that's what we're focusing on here in Wisconsin.
That is Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers. Governor, thank you, and best of luck to you.
Thanks a lot, Robin. Have a good day.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. That's why you need Indeed.com. Post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates using an intuitive online dashboard. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free at Indeed.com/here now. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply. Offer valid through March 31st, 2020.
And as we've been hearing, the White House task force is forecasting a best-case scenario of 100,000 to over 200,000 COVID-19 deaths in the U.S. if we take all necessary measures. The president said there will be millions of deaths if we don't. Well, one of those measures is simple. Wash your hands. You've heard it from your doctor, your boss, the governor, the president, your mother, and from Atul Gawande. 16 years ago, his research showed that simple signs in hospitals telling healthcare workers to wash their hands dramatically cut the rate of infections. Dr. Atul Gawande is now CEO of the new company Haven Health. They're trying to create better outcomes and lower healthcare costs. He's also a surgeon at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Massachusetts and chair of Lifebox, a nonprofit working to make surgery safer globally. We wanted his thoughts on COVID-19. Atul, Dr. Gawande, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, actually, I've been dying to know what you're thinking. So just right off the bat, what are you seeing that is giving you encouragement? What gives you the biggest concern? Start with the biggest concern.
I'm worried about what's emerged in multiple cities that go well beyond New York. We're talking New Orleans, Dallas, Atlanta, Detroit, Chicago, Philadelphia. Our death toll curve is worse than when China was at the same stage. 15 plus states with more than 1,500 cases. China only had one province. So again, this is a national epidemic, and we only have started treating it like it is a national epidemic in the last couple of days. I'm so glad the president reversed course and acknowledged that we're going to have to shelter in place to stay at home. But we have been late getting started, and that is worrisome.
Viruses don't know state borders.
They don't. And there is no part of the country where the virus is not spreading. Now, on the flip side, we are seeing that the playbook works. These key steps, staying home, physical distancing, the hand hygiene and cleaning that you talked about, it's only essential businesses that are open for the time being. And what we saw in China was that in Wuhan, about 4 weeks after they did the lockdown, the curve really flattened out.
Dr. Fauci is saying 100,000 to 200,000 would be great if we could keep the deaths to that. We're at 3,000 or more now. That would mean it would ratchet up to, you know, 10, 20, 30,000 a week.
It's frightening. And the range of what we see indicates that that's the curve we're on. You know, at the beginning of March, we had only like 100 cases. By March 26, we were at 100,000 cases. By April 3rd or so, we'll be at over 1 million cases. And it just goes compounding from there. The good news is we have started really at a national level, taking seriously our shelter in place thinking. And that allows that pace to slow down. Instead of every 3 days, it doubles every 5 days or 6 days. And that gives a chance for the hospitals to not get overwhelmed. And that helps them save more lives. You know, we are seeing the fever curve starting to turn the corner.
Okay, we'll talk about things that can be done. Because let's stay with hospitals, something you are, you know, so familiar with. You say that hospital workers need to be tested as they come in every day, screened for whether or not they have fevers. And it's not just because we need these workers to work with this very sick people. It's to keep them from being vectors.
That's right. In Italy, hospitals became a source of infection. That did not happen in Singapore, did not happen in Hong Kong, did not happen in South Korea. They had a playbook that worked. We can gear up and follow that playbook, and we've begun doing so. So what's in the playbook? You do need to check people when they come in the door. You don't have to test everybody, but you do need to ask people every day, do you have symptoms of a fever, a cough, a sore throat, muscle aches? It is an interesting question whether to ask people whether you have a loss of taste. There's lots of debate. There's some interesting anecdotes and cases that this may be an indicator also of COVID-19. And if you have these symptoms, don't come into the hospital. Go home and stay long enough to make sure that that has all gone away. Second, in Singapore, Hong Kong, et cetera, they have a surgical mask for all healthcare workers to wear when they come in the door. At my hospital, at the Brigham and Women's Hospital, we made that our policy and then have, you know, fought hard to make sure we maintain supplies. There are lots of hospitals now that have also adopted this policy of a symptom check and a surgical mask. And if supplies run short, we will give it first to the healthcare workers in the most critical areas like the emergency room.
You say you also, in a way, ration because you wear your mask all day. What's the best way to keep it clean?
Well, first of all, don't touch it. That's probably the number one thing. Part of the value of the mask is if you have the infection, it keeps you from coughing or infecting others. Second of all, it keeps you from touching your own mouth or nose or face. There are three or four methods that people are testing. You can use UV light. You can put it in the oven, 70 degrees Celsius, which does show that it kills the virus. Another approach is something called methylene blue that you can use regular operating room lights and soak it with this substance that allows the bacteria to get killed in the presence of light. Not ideal. Mm. You know, we need ordinary supplies.
You were on your list of what to do. I just want to jump in and ask one thing because
You
say, you know, maybe it's not the smartest thing to do to quarantine everyone who may have come in contact or been in the vicinity of someone who has COVID-19 or test positive for the coronavirus. You know, only the people who what?
Well, so that's really interesting, right? Singapore, Hong Kong quarantined only if you had more than 30 minutes exposure at less than 6 feet without a mask. And they had zero transmissions inside the hospitals. So that tells you something. It's from close, sustained contact with people and lack of hand hygiene after contact with secretions that is the cause of transmission. More and more, the policy that we're following, and it seems to be preventing healthcare transmissions, is that if you're exposed to someone, you have a mask, you get screened for whether you have symptoms, and if any symptoms appear, you make sure that you do not come into the hospital.
But if the symptoms don't appear, you don't have to sit home, and we don't have to lose as many healthcare workers as we're losing.
That's right. These measures we're testing out in the healthcare world, like wearing a mask and paying attention and tracking symptoms really carefully every day, might show us the way that we can all return to work while dealing with the fact that people without symptoms still can spread, but they're not as dangerous as the people with symptoms.
Yeah. Atul Gawande, you are speaking now probably to a lot of healthcare workers, nurses and doctors. What else do you want to tell healthcare workers?
I think a really important, powerful thing, which is happening in many places but is not universal yet, is you have to separate where the respiratory patients go from where the non-respiratory patients go. Separate wards, separate clinics, and separate teams, and putting them into a separate part of your medical facility is a important part of the playbook that has really worked. The final thing I'd have to say is that it's a scary time to be a healthcare worker and not know that the equipment you need is there, especially for clinicians who are, or any healthcare staff who are going to be around someone who is coughing or you need to put a breathing tube in them and be exposed to the possibility that the virus is being put out into the air. And I think it's a heroic effort. There is no question that we're putting ourselves at risk when we're going out there and don't know that we are going to have all the equipment we have. Some are having to make choices like, in my hospital, if the equipment's not there, sometimes, you know, an anesthesiologist will say, well, I don't feel we can put a patient to sleep. And I think every healthcare worker is making a choice for themselves about the risk they're willing to take. And it's appropriate and it's understandably a difficult time for all of us.
Well, and what do you say to, the civilians? There's not yet a sense in every pocket of the country that this is their story, too. You know, what do you say to the person who says, I live in Montana, you know, my neighbor's, 10 miles away? Or
if you're in a rural area and your neighbor's 10 miles away, you're socially distancing and you're doing great. By the time you see it in your neighborhood, the virus is already out of control. So you are unfortunately having to act ahead of when you see your neighbors and your town is getting hit, because in a week or less, it's going to be. Ohio is a very interesting place. It was the first state where they shut the restaurants and bars. They asked people to shelter in place. And Ohio did it well ahead of the curve. There was a lot of anger directed at the governor for doing this. And the result is it's one of the places where the projections look like they will not overrun the hospitals. They will peak in mid-April, and they will come out the other side without having, you know, endangered the healthcare system and the people who need to rely on it. That is the choice in front of those parts of the country where this won't peak until early May, and acting now is your chance to avoid that overrun. It is a dangerous virus, and an example of that is that a quarter of middle-aged people, a quarter of people aged 45, will be hospitalized with this virus in order to survive. And about 5 to 10% of them ended up needing ICU care. They have to be on a ventilator for days in order to survive. Yes, their death rate is low, but it's only low because you have a functioning healthcare system where they can rescue you. And it's an ordeal for that for those folks who get that sick.
Yeah. So a dangerous virus. That's Atul Gawande, CEO now of Haven Health, but also a longtime surgeon at Brigham and Women's Hospital, and chair of Lifebox, a not-for-profit that aims to make surgery safer globally, but also a longtime observer of how to make healthcare safer. And certainly his mandate, wash your hands, is one that we're listening to now. Dr. Gawande, thanks so much, and best of luck to you as you work in this.
Thank you.
And I just can't believe that I'm asking in an interview in 2020 how to wash and reuse a face mask.
In this era of social distancing, people are hungry for ways to connect. And one way to do that is to help those in need. Stephanie O'Neill tells us about a volunteer group that is doing just that in Santa Barbara County, California.
Ape Powell pulls his truck up to a donation tent in front of Santa Barbara's Cottage Hospital.
Hi, how's it going?
My name's Noel. I don't
know.
Noel?
Yeah. Ape.
All right, let's see.
From the back, he lifts out sealed boxes of protective equipment, including dozens of desperately needed masks for frontline healthcare workers.
These are N100s, so they're
even more
fancy ones.
Yeah.
There's 100 in each of those boxes.
Powell is executive director of the Santa Barbara Bucket Brigade. It's a group he and a handful of friends formed in early 2018. That's when a massive debris flow slammed into the nearby community of Montecito, killing 23 people. The disaster wiped out neighborhoods and filled hundreds of homes with a muddy slurry. After that, Powell says, the Bucket Brigade vowed to grow and stay connected to help out in future disasters.
Wildfires, mudslides, landslides, debris flows, and occasional floods.
Now more than 3,000 people have joined the Bucket Brigade, including Alexandra Williams. The Santa Barbara resident was among the first volunteers to answer the group's initial call for help.
We would show up with shovels, masks, whatever tools we needed to dig out mud. It was a lot of just muscles. We were using our muscles.
The coronavirus pandemic, though, is quite different. Volunteers must find ways to help older people, those with disabilities, homeless residents, and needy families without themselves getting sick. For Williams, that means phone checkups on a handful of women she'd been teaching in twice-weekly exercise classes.
Hello?
I'm calling to check in on you. How are you doing today?
Williams phones each of the five women every couple of days, checking on their emotional well-being, whether they need her to pick up any groceries, medicines, or other essentials.
My oldest is 92, and some of them are single and alone, and I don't want them to feel isolated.
This type of grassroots and widely cast social networking and volunteering is what anthropologist Julie Maldonado says is essential to helping vulnerable people get through disasters.
And those very even loose connections become really powerful and can often make the difference between survival and not.
And Maldonado, who teaches at UC Santa Barbara, says that's what defines a resilient community. During this time of self-isolation, she says, even reaching out to those you don't know is important. And that can be as simple as walking around your block and leaving your contact information inside your neighbor's mailbox, says the Bucket Brigade's Alexander Williams.
Even if they need nothing, it's still letting them know they're not alone.
So far during the coronavirus pandemic, about 300 Bucket Brigade volunteers have signed up to staff food banks, to provide senior meals, and to help with other services countywide. For NPR News, I'm Stephanie O'Neill in Santa Barbara.
And we've been hearing stories of neighbors helping neighbors all around the country. In Lee's Summit, Missouri, dozens of different families have been sitting down for dinner together in their separate driveways so people don't feel alone. In Putnam County, Tennessee, Terry Burrow wanted to check in on his neighbors, so he handed out two-sided construction paper to put in the windows. The green side means you're fine. The red side means you need some help, and Burrow checks the windows daily. Let us know what your neighborhood is doing at hereandnow.org. Florida has set up checkpoints to monitor incoming cars from coronavirus hotspots like New York and Louisiana. Anyone arriving from those areas is required to self-quarantine for 2 weeks. But the state is dealing with a crisis within its own borders. Nearly 7,000 confirmed cases of COVID-19 concentrated heavily in South Florida. Katie Switalski is a reporter with WLRN in Miami and joins us now. And Katie, every other state that's looking at numbers as bad as those in Florida has shut down. But your governor, Ron DeSantis, has refused to issue a stay-at-home order for the whole state. He said yesterday he's not getting that direction from the White House. Listen.
The task force has not recommended that to me. If they do, you know, obviously that would be something that would carry a lot of weight with me.
What has been the reaction there to DeSantis not telling people to stay at home?
Hi, Jeremy. It's resulted in a lot of local governments at the city level and also at the county level issuing their own orders, asking people to stay inside to varying levels of enforcement. And it's really a patchwork approach that varies in multiple spots around in a single county. And it's resulted in a lot of pressure on the governor from our members of Congress here in South Florida and a lot of local officials wondering why it's been put on them.
And is the expectation that he eventually will cave to the pressure and do it?
So right now he says he still doesn't want to. But again, it's hinging on he hasn't heard from the White House task force that that is something he should do. And I think if they recommended that, he said he would consider it. But right now, unless that were to happen, no, because I think his approach is the entire state is so big. And there are counties in Florida that don't have high numbers of cases that are documented yet. And so there's the economic pressure to keep what can stay open right now open.
Meanwhile, is Florida getting everything that it has asked for from the federal government, from the national stockpile? Because a lot of other governors are saying they're not getting what they need from Washington.
Florida is getting everything that it's asked for from that stockpile. Trump and our governor, Ron DeSantis, are very much political allies. They have a great relationship, and DeSantis has also been directing our emergency director, our emergency management director in Florida, to look at private vendors, look at private options for things like ventilators and order thousands, even if they're only getting delivered, a couple thousand at a time, whether that's tests, whether that's PPE, that personal protective equipment. DeSantis mentions a lot of N95 masks. He's been having dreams about N95 masks. That seems to be a really desired item.
Just briefly, what about the cruise ship situation? The Holland America is hoping to dock in South Florida. Four passengers have died on the ship already, but the governor doesn't want it to come ashore.
So there's actually two Holland America ships right now, the Rotterdam and the Zaandam. And they have sick people on board. They have tests on board. They've been able to pick up doctors, nurses, and medicine in Panama and Ecuador. But they are still waiting, as of now, for that permission to come to Port Everglades. Mm-hmm. At least the Zaandam, Port Everglades here, just, you know, near Fort Lauderdale, that's its home port. And it was always supposed to get back here a little later than now. But right now, our Broward County Commission is really frustrated that this has fallen on local decision-making. Several commissioners are looking for guidance from the federal government.
That is WLRN's Katie Switalski. Katie, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, we've been finding out this week what it means to be at more risk for infections from viruses like COVID-19. Today, meet Andrea Petrowski, a mother of two in Detroit, Michigan. Her youngest, 5.5-year-old Louisa, has different medical conditions that make a virus a mortal enemy. Her husband, Tom, is a dietitian at a Detroit hospital. To protect their daughter, he moved out to work. He's now working remotely, even from his hospital, in full quarantine, in the hopes he can come back to see his family. Andrea joins us now. And Andrea, this defensive posture is new to many of us, but not to your family.
You know, Louisa was born 5.5 years ago with a known condition. It's a very severe heart condition, and she's had several open heart surgeries to modify how her heart works. So our family has done a lot of things that we never would have imagined we'd be in the position to do. And one of those things was having our newborn baby stay from birth to 7 months old in a high complex unit at U of M for 7 months. So the rewards are great. You know, there were times after her first heart surgery, she was just 9 days old, where hospital staff in the ICU, they had to take precautions. She received a tracheostomy, which is an artificial airway, at 2 months old. This helped make it possible for her to at some point be removed from a ventilator and, you know, live with us at home on a home ventilator. So there was a lot that came with that in terms of having sanitary protocol, where we always made sure our hands were washed. We wouldn't come into a room if we were sick. As she's grown older and bigger, she's become more resilient. She had her tracheostomy removed at age 3, and with this virus, COVID-19, we've gone right back into isolation that we've done before.
But it sounds like even more. I mean, your husband, Tom, who works as a dietitian at a Detroit hospital, you know, he's staying out of the house. He's not coming home. So you're mothering alone. I mean, you must miss each other.
It's intense.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this could go on for months.
It could. He was working in a very high-risk hospital in Detroit that has the bulk of COVID-19 patients in our state.
This is quite something that your husband has chosen. I mean, he could have chosen to stay home with you and his children and not work. But I suppose economically that may have been tough.
Certainly wasn't an option. I mean, he's very committed to his patients and taking care of us as the sole income provider at this time. And his patients are very high risk in terms of being candidates for organ transplantation. So it would be just as detrimental for them to have that as it would our young child.
Do I hear another little person breathing there?
You do.
I thought so. Who we got?
She found me.
Hello. There's Louisa.
Would you like to say hello?
Hi.
Hi.
How are you doing?
Hi.
You bored?
Well, she gives a lot of nonverbal gestures right. When you're on the phone. So
but she's speaking for all of America right now, anxious and wants to get out of the house. Andrea, I just can't imagine that you have to be like a warrior, and that you could possibly bring something into your home that could harm your child is inconceivable.
What I want to express, though, is that we hear in the news that most people will be fine. They say most people will be fine. Children are at low risk. And we're finding out that's not true. There are a lot of families who have kids with some complex conditions and disabilities, and this would be detrimental to their well-being and even their life. In Michigan here, we've shut down all our schools for 2 weeks. We've canceled all of her routine medical care. So, you know, I can't say that she's really thriving at this point, but we're safe and we're well.
We could even trust when somebody says it's safe to go out. That might be hard for you to trust.
I tell myself we're just going to take this 1 week at a time because it's been really hard taking care of two kids, one with some complex medical needs. She's on several medications. She's, you know, prone to injury if I'm not carefully monitoring her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Social distancing, you know, is annoying to some people. Like, oh, I have to stay 6 feet away from someone in the Whole Foods. To you, it's life or death.
And I know I'm not the only parent in this position, but it puts me in so much despair to think that there are other families like ours who do not have these options. They might be on the front lines, whether it's, you know, working in a business capacity that supports medical workers or it's the grocery store. They can't all work remotely, and I want to bring that perspective to people. Our situation's really, I know it sounds intense, but it's not the worst case scenario. To me, the worst case scenario would be if Louisa were in the hospital and it could only be me by her side, or maybe not even me.
Right. And that is happening to some families. Well, Andrea Petrowski there in Detroit, we wish you all the best. And thank you so much for really, you know, letting people know what distancing really means for some families. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
So we are staying inside for Louisa.
The country with the highest death toll from COVID-19 remains Italy, more than 12,000. Italy has been in lockdown for 3 weeks, and we're joined now from Rome by Luigi D'Angelo, director of the country's Civil Protection Department. He manages Italy's emergency response. Mr. D'Angelo, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And Italy has now over 100,000 cases of COVID-19. That's more than any other country except the United States. But of course, you've been dealing with this outbreak far longer than we have. Are things getting any better in Italy?
Things are getting better because the measures that we have taken so far have been respected by all the citizens, and we are now in this restriction since 3 weeks almost right now, and we think that these measures are getting now their benefit for us all.
How long do you think that the restrictions on movement in Italy will continue?
So far, the restriction should end by the 3rd of April, but our scientists and all the technicians are advising the government in posticipating this restriction. So we think that probably they will last till the end of April so far.
The end of April. How are your hospitals doing? We know that the hospitals in northern Italy were completely overwhelmed with patients. Are they getting any relief at this point?
That has been the main problem that we had since the beginning. And unfortunately, this virus attacked us in the hospital, and they have been contaminated, doctors, nurses. But so far, all the measures have been taken. Now there are preventive measures for surveillance. So the people, before entering the hospital, they pass through a triage. So what we suffered at the beginning and the lessons learned that we have gained from this bad experience is to prevent the diffusion, first of all, within the hospital. So now we have adopted adequate measures for taking care of the hospital, but first of all, we have reinforced the basis health assistance. So the people, they are not requested to go to the hospital, but they have to call their doctor, and the doctor can go home and visit them, so just to prevent that they get to the hospitals.
Just to keep the 6 people out of the hospital unless they absolutely have to be there.
Yeah, exactly, because at the end of the story, this is a war, and our soldiers now are doctors and nurses, and we have to do our best to protect them and to prevent them from being contaminated.
Do you have all of the supplies that you need? Do the doctors have the masks that they need to do their work safely?
It has been our main concern since the beginning. It has been our limit in responding to this emergency because, unfortunately, we had a lack of these dispositive, lack of face masks, ventilators, respirators. But now we have improved. Fortunately, China has started to provide goods, and we are getting more and more mask, ventilator, and other stuff. So today we can provide our doctor and nurses with adequate number of materials.
Since this virus has attacked Italy and other countries, the economy has basically shut down. Are you thinking about what that is going to mean for you after you're done battling the virus? Are you thinking about recovery yet, or is it too soon?
Yeah, this would be a very bad perspective, and that's why the government has already adopted important measures. Some money is flowing to the territory, to the enterprises, and we issued a decree from the head of Civil Protection Department that flow to the territory over 500 million of euro that will support fragile people and people that are in need.
Why do you think the outbreak in Italy has been so much worse than other countries in Europe so far?
We are still investigating. Probably what we thought that was too far from us in China immediately came, and probably the virus came even before, because probably we have been attacked by end of January, early February, and it started spreading so much and so far and so wide in our territory, especially in the north, that we only received the effect a few weeks later, and of course a lot of things had already happened.
Finally, let me just ask you, you've been living with this for many weeks. What is your message to the United States as we are at what looks like it could be just the beginning here?
My message is especially to the citizens of the United States and to all the other countries that could probably be affected. Because despite the governmental measures, despite any law, what makes the real difference in this story is the behavior of the people. If we stay home, if we respect social distance, then we can come through and we can work out from this situation.
That is Luigi D'Angelo, who is the head of Italy's Civil Protection Department. He manages the country's emergency response. Thank you so much for joining us, and best of luck to you. We're all thinking about the people of Italy in this crisis.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Robin, it seems like that's the message from just about everybody. Stay home.
Stay home.
Makes a big difference.
Yep.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.